astonished at Colonel Sakagawa's unexpected behavior. But he recognized that he deserved the rebuke, so he mumbled, "I'm tired of living without a woman." This introduced a less military note into the discussion, and Kamijiro quit being an imperial colonel and became once more a friend. "Hashimoto-san, it was bad enough to go to such a house, but to bring home one of the girls and to marry her, you must put strength in your stomach and be a decent Japanese." "She isn't from one of the houses," Hashimoto explained. "She's a good girl from a good, hard-working family." "But she's not Japanese," Kamijiro argued. He made no progress with Hashimoto, who was determined not to live alone any longer. Since there were no Japanese girls available on Kauai, he would live with his Hawaiian and marry her. But in his ardor for feminine companionship, he had failed to consider the even greater ardor of the Japanese community, and when it was noised abroad what he had done, he experienced the full, terrible power of the sacred Japanese spirit. "You have sullied the name of Japan," warned the older men who had learned to live without women. "You have disgraced the blood of Japan," others mourned. "Have you no pride, no Yamato spirit?" younger men asked. "Don't you realize that you bring disgrace upon us all?" his friends pleaded. Hashimoto proved himself to be a man of fortitude. "I will not live alone any longer," he repeated stubbornly. "I am going to live with my wife, the way a man should." "Then you will live forever apart from the Japanese community," a stern old man cried. He had been in Kauai for many years, also longing for a woman, but he had behaved himself as a decent Japanese should, and now on behalf of all the emperor's subjects he pronounced the ostracism. "Because you have been shameless, and because you have not protected the sacred blood of Japan, you must live apart. We don't want a man like you to work with us, or to eat with us, or to live with us. Get out." Hashimoto began to feel the awful force of this sentence and pleaded, "But a man needs a woman. What do you expect me to do?" A fiery younger man replaced the one who had delivered the ostracism, and this one shouted belligerently, "We don't expect you to marry other women. You're no Chinese who is willing to marry anybody he can get his hands on. You're a Japanese." "What am I to do?" Hashimoto screamed. "Live alone all my life?" "Use the prostitutes each month, like we do," the fiery young man cried, referring to the girls which the plantation bosses provided on paydays, moving them from camp to camp according to schedule. "But the time comes when a man doesn't want prostitutes any longer," Hashimoto pleaded. "Then live without them," an older man snapped, "like Akagi-san." "Hey, you, Akagi-san, how many years you live without a woman?"
19,
a wiry veteran of the cane fields replied. "And you, Yamasaki-san?"
17,
a sunburned Hiroshima man replied. "They are decent, honest Japanese," the younger man shouted. "They will wait here till they die, hoping for a Japanese wife. But if none arrives, they would not think of marrying anyone else. In them, the Japanese spirit is high. In you, Hashimoto, there is no honor. Now get out." So Hashimoto left Ishii Camp and lived with his Hawaiian wife in the town of Kapa'a. He had to be fired by Hanakai Plantation, for other Japanese refused to work with an outcast who had sullied the blood of Japan. Sometimes, when men from the camp went into Kapa'a to play a little pool or get drunk on okolehau, a potent illegal brew made from the root of the tea plant, they would meet their former friend Hashimoto, but they never spoke. He could not attend the Japanese church, nor any of the socials, nor play in Japanese games, nor listen to the heroic reciters who came from time to time from Tokyo, spending days among the camps, reciting the glories of Japanese history. From all such normal intercourse, Hashimoto was excluded. And although the dreadful example of his banishment was frequently recalled by other young men who may have wanted women, and who were certainly tempted to marry Hawaiian or Chinese or drifting white girls, his proscribed name was never mentioned. Men hungry for girls did not warn each other. Remember what happened to Hashimoto. Instinctively, they remembered. For of him it had once been said, "All Japan will be ashamed of what you have done." And the young men were convinced that throughout every village of Japan the evil word had been passed. Hashimoto Tsutokichi married a Hawaiian woman, and all Japan is ashamed of him. What Honolulu thought of the marriage was unimportant, for Honolulu did not matter. But what Japan thought was of towering concern, for every man in Ishii Camp intended one day to return to Japan, and to take back with him any wife other than a decent Japanese was unthinkable. The years following annexation had not been kind to Wild Whip Hawksworth. In business, the more stodgy members of Hawksworth and Hale had kept him from assuming any position of leadership within the company, so that even though his sugar lands irrigated by artesian wells flourished and made him a millionaire several times over, he was denied, for moral reasons, the command of H&H to which his talents entitled him. So he had come to Kauai. With driving energy, he had imported hundreds of Japanese laborers and had built irrigation ditches, cleared land, and shown Kauai how to grow sugar by the most improved methods. He had erected his own mill and ground his own cane, filling the stubby cargo ships of the H&H line with his product. With equal energy, he had built the mansion at Hanakai, personally placing the croton bushes and the hibiscus. When the cut timbers arrived from China, he supervised their erection, and it was he who added the idea of a broad area covered by flagstone through whose chinks grass grew, so that one walked both on the firmness of stone and the softness of grass. When he finished, he had a magnificent house, perched on the edge of a precipice at whose feet the ocean thundered. But it was a house that knew no happiness, for shortly after Whip had moved in with his third wife, the Hawaiian-Chinese beauty Ching Ching, who was pregnant at the time, she had caught him fooling around with the brothel girls that flourished in the town of Kapa'a. Without even a scene of recrimination, Ching Ching had simply ordered a carriage and driven back to the capital town of Lihue, where she boarded an H&H steamer for Honolulu. She divorced Whip, but kept both his daughter Iliki and his yet unborn son, John. Now there were two Mrs. Whipple Hawksworths in Honolulu, and they caused some embarrassment to the more staid community. There was his first wife, Iliki Janders Hawksworth, who moved in only the best missionary circles, and there was Ching Ching Hawksworth, who lived within the Chinese community. The two never met, but Hawksworth and Hale saw to it that each received a monthly allowance. The sums were generous, but not so much so as those sent periodically to Wild Whip's second wife, the fiery Spanish girl Aloma Duarte Hawksworth, whose name frequently appeared in New York and London newspapers. During these early years of the 20th century, Wild Whip lived alone at Hanakai, a driven, miserable man. Periodically, he spent lost days in some back room of the Kapa'a brothels, competing with his field hands for the favors of Oriental prostitutes. At other times, he would pull himself together and organize the dreamlike sporting events that were a feature of Kauai. For example, he kept a large stable of quarter horses and a fine grassy oval on which to race them at meetings where Chinese and Hawaiian bettors went wild and lost a year's wages on one race. Part of Whip's distrust of the Japanese stemmed from the fact that they did not bet madly on his horse races, for he said, "A man who can't get excited about a horse race is really no man at all, and you can have the little yellow bastards." But when it was pointed out that the Japanese enabled him to grow more cane than any other plantation in the islands, he always acknowledged that fact. "Work is their god, and I respect them for it. But my love I reserve for men who like horses." The highlight of any season came when Wild Whip organized one of his polo tournaments, for this was the conspicuous game of the islands, and he maintained a line of 37 choice ponies. The games took place on a lovely grassy field edging the wild cliffs of Hanakai. But the high moment of any game occurred when a sudden shower would toss a rainbow above the players so that two riders fighting for the ball could pass mysteriously from shower into sunlight and back into the soft, misty rain. A polo game at Hanakai was one of the most beautiful sports a man could witness, and islanders often walked for miles to sit along the croton bushes. Wild Whip played a fine game, and in order to maintain the quality of his team, always hired his lunas personally. Sitting carelessly in a deep chair, he watched the man approach down the long lanai and studied his gait. "Limber, supple, nice walk, that one," he would muse. His first question was invariable. "Young man, have you a good seat?" If the man stuttered or failed to understand what a good seat implied, Whip courteously excused him from further consideration. But if the man said, "I've been riding since I was 3, Whip proceeded with the interview. Traditionally on Kauai, lunas were either German immigrants or Norwegians, and among themselves they circulated the warning, "Don't apply at Hanakai unless you're good at polo." When he hired a man, Whip laid down 3 requirements. "Polished boots that come to the knee, and I want them polished till they gleam. White riding breeches, and I want them white. And finally, lunas on Hanakai never strike the workman." Actually, few of the Germans and Norwegians were good at polo when they first started work, but Whip gave lessons every afternoon at 4, and in time, even the Japanese became proud when their boss and their lunas defended Hanakai's championship against all comers from Kauai. But major excitement occurred periodically when a picked team from Honolulu, consisting mostly of Janderses and Whipples and Hewletts who had perfected their game at Yale, for many years in a row the stars of the Yale 4 came from Hawaii, chartered a boat to bring their ponies and their cheering section on an invasion of Kauai. Then hales from all the local plantations moved out to Hanakai. Enormous beds 10 feet square were thrown along the lanai, with 8 or 10 haphazard people to the bed, and kitchens were set up behind the casuarina trees. In the evenings, gala dances were held with men in formal dress and women brilliant in gowns from Paris and Canton. Frequently, tournaments were staged with 4 or 5 competing teams, and all lived at Hanakai for a week. Then life was glorious, with champagne and flirtations, and often Wild Whip succeeded in sequestering one of the visitors' wives in some darkened bedroom, so that over the polo games at Hanakai there hung always the ominous shadow of potential scandal. There was another shadow, too, for if the polo field and the croton bushes were made possible only by the protecting rim of silent casuarina trees, which kept away the storms and the killing salt, so the life of the Haoles was protected by the rim of silent Japanese laborers who lived in the womanless huts and who kept away the sweat, the toil, and the work of building the future. It was curious that when the men of Hawaii returned to Yale for alumni celebrations, and when their former classmates who now lived in respectable centers like Boston and Philadelphia asked, "What holds a brilliant man like you in Hawaii?" the Janderses and the Hales and the Whipples usually replied longingly, "Have you ever seen a polo game at Hanakai, the ocean at your feet, the storms sweeping in with rainbows? When your pony slips, he leaves a bright red scar across the turf. You could live 100 years in Philadelphia and never see anything like the polo season at Hanakai." The Yale men who had gone to live in Philadelphia never understood, but their former classmates who had played polo along the Hawaii circuit never forgot that Hawaii in those years provided one of the best societies on earth. When the polo players had departed, when the field kitchens were taken down, and when the patient little Japanese gardeners were tending each cut in the polo turf as if it were a personal wound, Wild Whip would retire to his sprawling mansion overlooking the sea and get drunk. He was never offensive and never beat anyone while intoxicated. At such times he stayed away from the brothels in Kapa'a and away from the broad lanai from which he could see the ocean. In a small, darkened room, he drank, and as he did so, he often recalled his grandfather's words. Girls are like stars, and you could reach up and pinch each one on the points. And then in the east, the moon rises, enormous and perfect. And that's something else, entirely different. It was now apparent to Whip, in his 45th year, that for him the moon did not intend to rise. Somehow he had missed encountering the woman whom he could love as his grandfather had loved the Hawaiian princess Noelani. He had known hundreds of women, but he had found none that a man could permanently want or respect. Those who were desirable were mean in spirit, and those who were loyal were sure to be tedious. It was probably best, he thought at such times, to do as he did, know a couple of the better girls at Kapa'a, wait for some friend's wife who was bored with her husband, or trust that a casual trip through the more settled camps might turn up some workman's wife who wanted a little excitement. It wasn't a bad life, and was certainly less expensive in the long run than trying to marry and divorce a succession of giddy women. But often, when he had reached this conclusion, through the bamboo shades of the darkened room in which he huddled, a light would penetrate, and it would be the great moon, risen from the waters to the east, and now passing majestically high above the Pacific. It was an all-seeing beacon, brilliant enough to make the grassy lawns of Hanakai a sheet of silver, probing enough to find any mansion tucked away beneath the casuarina trees. When this moon sought out Wild Whip, he would first draw in his feet, trying like a child to evade it. But when it persisted, he often rose, threw open the lanai screens, and went forth to meet it. He would stand in the shimmering brilliance for a long time, listening to the surf pound in below, and in its appointed course the moon would disappear behind the jagged hills to the west. It was uncanny, at such moments, how the Hawaiian men who worked for Whip would sense his mood. In twos and threes they would appear mysteriously with ukuleles, strumming them idly in subtle island harmonies. And Whip would hear them and cry, "Hey, you, Pupuli, you come!" And the men would unostentatiously gather about him, and he would grab a ukulele and begin to chant some long-forgotten song his grandmother had taught him. He became a Hawaiian, moody, distant, hungry for the message of the night. And for hours he would sing with his men, one song after another. A field hand would grunt, "Hey, boss, you got some okole hao?" And Whip would open some whiskey, and the bottle would pass reflectively from mouth to mouth, and the old laments of Hawaii would continue. At dawn, the men would inconspicuously shuffle away, one or two at a time. But the man whose ukulele Wild Whip had borrowed would linger on until at last he would have to say, "Mo better I go now, boss." And the long night would end. After such interludes, Wild Whip always turned to his pineapples. On a well-protected plateau, about the size of two tennis courts, perched at the head of the Hanakai Valley and about 200 yards from the African tulip tree, he had constructed a special field and fertilized it for the propagation of pineapples. For it was Whip's belief that ultimately the growing of this fruit on high fields and sugar on low was the destiny of Hawaii. To anyone who would listen, he was eager to explain his theories. "Look, the two things are natural partners. Sugar needs water, a ton of water for each pound of sugar. Pineapple doesn't. Sugar thrives on low fields, pineapples on high. At the very point on a hillside where it's no longer profitable to irrigate for sugar, that's where pineapple grows best. And if you have sugar growing down here and pineapple up there, when the fruit gets ripe, you drench it in sugar, can it, and sell both at a huge profit. Why in hell do you suppose I came to Kauai? Because it offers an ideal combination of sugar lands and pineapple lands. Before I leave, I'll have the secret that'll make Hanakai the richest plantation in the world." Whenever Whip looked at the land of Hawaii, with its fortunate combination of high dry fields and low wet ones, he became excited. But when he looked at his experimental pineapple beds, he became furious. For he had in his trial fields more than 19 different kinds of pineapple, and not one of them worth a goddamn. He showed his visitors all that he had found so far. That one with the savage hooks along its leaves, they'd cut you into pieces trying to harvest in a field full of them. They're the Pernambuco, and you can have every damned Pernambuco ever grown. The striped one is the Zebrina. Looks good, but the fruit's foul. That interesting one in three colors is the Bractitis, and for a time I had hopes for it, but the fruit's too small. I have plants that look like rat tails, others that look like whips, some with teeth like sickles. The only two possibly worth bothering with are the Guatemala and the New Guinea, but they don't prosper here. That means you have nothing really worth working on, agriculturalists asked. Yep, wouldn't try to grow any of them commercially. Then you conclude that pineapples aren't suited to Hawaii? Well, I wouldn't admit that. You got something else in mind? Some new breed? Maybe. Maybe someday we'll find exactly the right fruit for these islands. At such times, Hawksworth became hard and secretive, for if he was no longer obsessed by any one woman, and if he had reached a reluctant truce with the standard patterns of love, he did entertain a positive lust for something he had once seen. In 1896, a Rio de Janeiro hotel had served him a cayenne pineapple, and the instant he had seen that barrel-shaped, sweet, and heavy fruit, he had known that this was the pineapple for Hawaii. He had expected that it would be simple to go to some agriculturist and say, "I'd like 5,000 cayenne plants." And he had tried to do so. But he quickly found that the French, who controlled that part of the Guiana coast where this fortunate mutation of the pineapple family had developed, were as excited about its prospects as he. No cayenne plants were allowed outside the colony. At the seaport of Cayenne, outgoing luggage was minutely inspected, so that when Whipple Hawksworth and wife Ching Ching from Rio arrived in French Guiana, the government knew before they landed that he was the big planter from Hawaii and that he was going to try to steal some cayenne plants. Consequently, with Gallic perfidy, they served Whip an endless succession of perfect cayenne pineapples, heavy, succulent, and aromatic. But no cayenne plant did he see. When he casually suggested a visit to one of the plantations, it rained. When he tried to bribe a scurrilous type to bring him some roots, the man was a government spy, placed outside the hotel for that special purpose. And when, in frustration, he decided to go home empty-handed, the customs officials searched every cubic inch of his luggage with the smiling assurance that, "We suspect attempts are being made to smuggle guns to the prisoners on Devil's Island." Whip smiled back and said, "I agree, you must be very careful." So he got no pineapple plants. He bought substitutes and cared for them tenderly, for he realized that the cayenne itself must have sprung from some chance cross-fertilization of two types which of themselves were nothing. Therefore, the meanest rat-tailed, scrawny plant in Whip's experimental field received the same care as the best Guatemala. But the fruit that resulted fell so far short of a cayenne that Whip became increasingly morbid on the subject. From Australia, he imported